released after years in the wings following his disastrous consulship of 100 BC, he'd had a taste of military glory and the military life again in the social war. He felt himself, even though he was an old man now, he felt himself back in the public light, once more reliving his days as the military hero of the Roman people. And although Sulla had been appointed through the proper circles, if you want to think of it that way, through the proper procedure, had been appointed to the command against Mithridates, Marius took the other route. He suborned a tribune of the people, Publius Sulpicius Rufus, to bring a bill in front of the tribal assembly of the plebs, assigning the same command to Marius. Amidst scenes of tremendous disorder and violence, the bill was passed. Sulpicius' supporters, by the way, showed up with daggers concealed in their garments, and when a tribune was speaking against the bill, he was cut down where he stood on the platform. The situation illustrates perfectly the conflict between the two routes, the two methods of using the Roman constitution that was now becoming increasingly common in the course of the revolution. The route of the optimates, using the Senate, having assigned Sulla in the traditional way the command against Mithridates. Now the route of the popularis, using a tribune of the people and the tribal assembly of the plebs, having assigned the same command to Marius. The situation was, of course, intolerable, but Sulla's reaction to it was far worse and set the worst precedent yet in the Roman Revolution. Sulla, when he heard the news about Marius' appointment to what he considered to be his command, was in South Italy in the area of Campania, gathering his troops, 6 legions of men. Hearing that Marius had been appointed by a vote of the people, he suborned his troops. He called on them to free Rome from tyrants. He called on them to support his own honour. No doubt he made them promises of rewards should they do so. Despite the fact, and this is a very interesting detail, despite the fact that all but one of his senior officers disagreed with the action and refused to participate, the rank and file followed. And Sulla turned the army assigned to him by the Senate of Rome on his native country. It took him several days to reach Rome, and of course delegations were coming out from the city to try and calm down the situation. They repeatedly asked Sulla, "Why are you doing this? Why are you turning an army of the Roman people against the Roman people?" Sulla's response is very illustrative. "To free her from tyrants," he said. In Sulla's mind, he's posing as a liberator. He's doing something honourable. He's doing something to save the libertas of the Roman state, even as he's setting an example that will ultimately ensure the destruction of that state and its transformation into a monarchy. Very interesting illustration of the way the mindset of the main protagonist of the Roman Revolution could operate. Sulla's troops arrived in Rome and were not well greeted by the populace. They were pelted with dung and tiles and so forth from the balconies and roofs of the city. Marius and Sulpicius had rustled up whatever forces they could in the city. Open warfare took place in the heart of the Roman Empire, in the Roman Forum itself, and on the hills and in the streets neighbouring the Forum. Open battles between Roman soldiers. Sulla was victorious. Sulpicius hunted down and murdered. Marius fled. Marius' flight from Rome, by the way, which lasted the best part of several months, is presented in our sources in a very Spielbergian sort of way. It's incredibly dramatic. He's constantly running away with Sulla's cavalry at his heels. He's hiding in marshes and in caves and people's barns in their back gardens trying to get away from his pursuers. He finally makes his way over to Africa, where of course many of his veterans from the Jugurthine War are located, and finds safety there. Having driven Marius out of Rome, then Sulla settled the affairs of the city as best he could, put a bounty on Marius's head as a public enemy, and went off east to fight Mithridates as he initially was supposed to do. So Sulla then, in capturing Rome, in trying to reinforce or preserve the traditional government of Rome, in fact had carried out the single most revolutionary act yet in the Roman Revolution. With this precedent now on the books, if you want to think of it that way, with this new boundary of behavior having been breached, the floodgates were wide open, and the possibilities for mayhem and violence in the future virtually limitless. Marius, once Sulla had left for the east, returned to Italy with supporters from Africa and joined another interesting figure, a rebel consul, a man called Lucius Cornelius Cinna, the anglicized pronunciation being Cinna, and that's what I intend to use from here on in, even though it should be pronounced Cinna. Lucius Cornelius Cinna then joins forces with Marius. They march their forces on Rome in 87 BC, capture the city, and apparently wreak a dreadful vengeance on all those who had supported Sulla's action the previous year. Marius appoints himself consul for the seventh time for the year 86 BC, but dies within a month of taking office. However, with the death of Marius, Marius' supporters and those of Cinna did not just evaporate. What we now have is a rather odd situation of Sulla at the head of a Roman army fighting a foreign enemy of Rome, Mithridates in Asia, fighting an enemy of a Rome in the control of his political opponents. In fact, the situation gets somewhat ludicrous. The Cinnan-controlled government in Rome, it seems, almost refuses to accept that there is already a Roman army in the field and sends out its own army to fight Mithridates. Of course, the two Roman armies in Asia spend as much time fighting each other as they do fighting Mithridates, and the whole situation becomes virtually comic. Sulla, however, is very keen to get back to Italy and resolve the situation with his political opponents. And after concluding a somewhat disgraceful peace with Mithridates in 85 BC, the king doesn't really suffer any severe punishment for his mass slaughter of Romans and Italians in the Asiatic Vespers. Sulla brings his army home to Italy in 84 or 83, sometime over the winter of 84 or 83, normally the event dated to 83 BC. It must be said that Cinna's control of Rome was relatively moderate. It was an autocracy of sorts. He simply appointed himself consul and nominated his colleagues. No elections were held, but nonetheless, it was relatively moderate. It's not as if Cinna was a violent tyrant in the city. But of course, he was a political opponent of Sulla, and there could be little doubt what was to happen when Sulla brought his men back from Italy. Cinna himself was killed by his own troops in a mutiny in 84 BC while trying to gather them and oppose Sulla across the Adriatic in the area of Dalmatia. Troops mutinied against him and killed him. But the supporters of Marius and Cinna continued to resist, raised what troops they could, and when Sulla landed in Italy in 83 BC, all-out war broke out in Italy between the supporters of Marius and Cinna and Sulla and his troops from the east. The war lasted a year and a half. It was brutal and vicious, as all civil wars tend to be, but it left Sulla in control of Rome and of Italy. What happened next marks, in many ways, some of the darkest pages of our story. Sulla entered Rome, bringing with him several thousand prisoners, Samnite prisoners who had fought against him. The Samnites, of course, had fought against Sulla in the social war and didn't like him personally, so they naturally flocked to the banners of his opponents. He brought the Samnites into the city and grouped them together in the Circus Maximus, the great chariot racing arena in Rome. He then convened a meeting of the Senate in the nearby temple. As the Senate convened, on a given command, all the prisoners, some 3,000, were slaughtered in the Circus Maximus. A tumultuous noise emanated from this event. The senators inquired, "What's that noise? What's happening?" Sulla responded coldly, "Some enemies of the state are receiving their just punishment." No one could be in any doubt as to what awaited the enemies of Sulla, now classified as the enemies of the state. It's worth reading a protracted passage from Plutarch's Life of Sulla to illustrate what happened next. Plutarch writes, "Sulla now devoted himself entirely to the work of butchery. The city was filled with murder, and there was no counting the executions or setting a limit to them. Many people were killed because of purely personal ill feeling. They had no connection with Sulla in any way, but Sulla, in order to gratify members of his own party, permitted them to be done away with. Finally, one of the younger men, Gaius Metellus, ventured to ask Sulla in the Senate at what point this terrible state of affairs was to end, and how much further would he proceed before they could expect a cessation of what was now going on. "We are not asking you," he said, "to pardon those whom you have decided to kill. All we ask is that you should free from suspense those whom you have decided not to kill." Sulla replied that he was not yet sure whom he would spare, and Metellus at once said, "Then let us know who you intend to punish." Sulla said that he would do this. Then, immediately, and without consulting any magistrate, Sulla published a list of 80 men to be condemned. I should intercede here that these lists were posted in the forum, in a public spot in the forum. And these lists give the name to this procedure called proscription, writing up, the writing up in a public place of a name. To return to Plutarch's narrative. Public opinion was horrified. But after a single day's interval, he published another list containing 220 more names, and the next day, a third list with the same number of names in it. And in the public speech which he made on the subject, he said that he was publishing the names of all those whom he happened to remember. Those who escaped his memory for the moment would have their names put up in due course. He also condemned anyone who sheltered or attempted to save a person whose name was on the lists. Death was the penalty for such acts of humanity, and there were no exceptions in the cases of brothers, sons, or parents. On the other hand, the reward for murder was 2 talents, and this sum was paid to anyone who killed a condemned man, even though it was a slave who killed his master, or a son his father. In other words, to intercede, the proscriptions meant that it was open season on those people who were proscribed. Also, and this was regarded as one of the greatest injustices of all, says Plutarch, he took away all civil rights from the sons and grandsons of those on the lists and confiscated the property of all of them. These lists were published not only in Rome, but in every city of Italy. No place remained undefiled by murder, neither temple of God, nor hearth of hospitality, nor ancestral home. Husbands were slaughtered in the embrace of their wedded wives, sons in the arms of their mothers. And those who were killed in the passion of the moment, or because of some private hatred, were as nothing compared to those who were butchered for the sake of their property, which was confiscated, you see, and auctioned off. In fact, says Plutarch, it became a regular thing to say among the executioners that so-and-so was killed by his big mansion, so-and-so by his gardens, so-and-so by his hot water installations. There was, for instance, one Quintus Aurelius, a man who had nothing to do with politics and who imagined that he was only connected with these disastrous events insofar as he sympathized with others who were in distress. He went into the forum and, reading through the list of the condemned, came upon his own name. "Things are bad for me," he said. "I have been hunted down by my Alban estate." And he had not gone far before he was cut down by someone who had, in fact, been hunting after him. Such is Plutarch's description of the proscriptions. Thousands perished in these purges. Their property was confiscated and auctioned off at knockdown prices to friends of Sulla in the forum. The heads of those who were executed were hung from the speaker's platform in the forum or displayed on spikes around about. This process went on for the best part of a year, and sometime during it, Sulla decided to legitimate his position and settle the affairs of the state. He resurrected in 82 or 81 BC the ancient office of dictator, which had been out of favour since the end of the Second Punic War. If we recall, this office was by tradition to be held by one individual for a 6-month period to carry out a specific task that would be listed in the title of the dictatorship. Sulla's dictatorship had the novel title, The Dictator, in Latin, Legibus Scribundus Re Publicae Constituendi. He was dictator for writing laws and organizing the state. That is, over everything. What's more, rather than holding the office for 6 months, Sulla was to hold the office for as long as he saw fit. With these powers, he redrafted the government of Rome. Sulla's reforms his legislation, issued in the form of dictatorial decrees that were not open to question or veto, can be described as reactionary. He intended to turn the clock back on the revolution. He intended to turn the clock back on the rise of the populares. He issued a series of laws that, for instance, muzzled the tribunate and restricted the rights of the tribal assembly of the plebs. Some examples. Tribunes could not propose legislation to the tribal assembly of the plebs. Any legislation that was to be proposed had to be passed by the Senate. And the Senate now was given the right of vetoing plebiscites, decisions of the tribal assembly of the plebs. As a disincentive to the young to stand for the office of the tribunate, he decreed that anyone who had been a tribune could not stand for any further office in the Roman Cursus Honorum. Effectively, if you wanted to stand for the tribunate, that was the beginning and end of your political career. So that was one very important part of Sulla's legislative program, was an attempt to turn the clock back on the rise of the popularis movement, on the rise of the movement of tribunes and the tribal assembly of the plebs as a major power in politics. He also reformed the Senate, expelling many and installing newcomers, who you won't be surprised to hear, were supporters of Sulla. The Senate now reached very high numbers, maybe 1,000, and as a result, these were staffed overwhelmingly by Sulla's supporters. The demographics of the body changed considerably. He also introduced various laws that we won't have to look at in detail that effectively tried to prevent army commanders in the provinces from doing what he himself had done in turning their armies against their native state. In addition to his various politically motivated laws and regulations, Sulla instituted several laws that were very sensible in nature and stood long after his death and became regular part of the Roman state. For instance, he was the first one to establish permanent standing courts. Up to that time, courts had been ad hoc, summoned as needed. Sulla now established a series of courts to deal with cases of violence, murder, poisoning, embezzlement, forgery, and so forth, that were standing courts, staffed, of course, by senators, and which survived long after his own death. And he also instituted alterations and changes in the cursus honorum. He increased the number of sub magistracies and stiffened the age limits, for instance, for candidates for the various offices in the Roman system of office holding. So really, under Sulla, the process of evolution that we described when looking at the Roman system of government continues. It's not as if it suddenly stops with Sulla. In 79 BC, perhaps 2 years, possibly 2.5 or 3 years into his dictatorship, Sulla reckoned that his job was done. And remarkably, he resigned his dictatorship and retired to private life, and if we believe our sources, to indulging an impressive litany of sexual perversions until he finally died in 78 BC. By all means, peacefully in his bed. Sulla's career is emblematic in many ways of the stage that the Roman Revolution had reached and of the direction that Roman politics was taking. As a person, Sulla is an intriguing figure, given to bouts of lethargy and also great periods of action, an odd mix of mediocrity and brilliance, placidity. He could forgive people as easily as he could condemn them. Some have regarded him as a sociopath, and that's quite possible, although such psychiatric diagnoses at this distance in time are impossible to be sure, but it's possible that he was sociopathic. His career is especially illustrated, I think, by his response to the delegations coming out of Rome as he turned his army on the city in 88 BC. It's really very illustrative of the way that the Roman Revolution worked. Here is a man doing a dreadful thing. He's knowingly suborned the loyalty of his troops and is turning them against his native country. But he justifies it by saying his native country is in the hands of tyrants. We'll see this justification used again and again by revolutionaries who use their armies against Rome. They're only freeing Rome from tyrants. He felt himself bound by necessity and by the need to maintain the liberty of the state to carry out this revolutionary act. In other words, he reacted to circumstances as he saw fit at the time. Sulla's vision was a narrow one. He only looked to the immediate circumstances that he faced, and in doing so, he set a precedent that was to be horribly abused in future years. In fact, we'll see within a matter of months of his death. He also had a narrow vision when it came to dealing with the problems of the state. We have seen that his program of legislation, his program for dealing with the problems of the state, was essentially a reactionary one. He wanted to set the clock back and restore the authority of the Senate through legislation, through dictatorial legislation. We see that this was absolutely doomed to failure, this approach. Setting the clock back is not always the best approach to dealing with new problems in a state, and certainly in Sulla's case, it was doomed to failure. The tribunate and the tribal assembly of the plebs was simply too useful a tool to be left in abeyance for long. And within a decade of his death, all of his legislation was to be washed away, and the Roman Revolution geared up to its final and bloodiest stages, as we'll see in future lectures. Another one of Sulla's, absolutely one of his worst precedents that he set, was the mass execution through the proscriptions of his opponents. This is taking the sort of mob rule that we've seen already, used by tribunes and so forth, to whole new heights. This is not an occasional riot. This is not a planned assassination of an individual who speaks against you. This isn't even going around with bodyguards to protect you or to use as hired thugs against your opponents. There was, by the way, this is just a little anecdote, but there was one tribune at this era who used to go around with a hired gang of ruffians that he called his anti-Senate, which I think is a good illustration of the way that the popularis thought. But the proscriptions mark something much more than this. This is the systematic, organized hunting down of your political opponents, not just in Rome, but all across Italy, in a state-sponsored purge of all political opponents of your enemies. This as well, we'll see, was a feature of the revolution that was to resurrect itself in the years following the assassination of Caesar. So all in all then, the career of Sulla is a rather harrowing one and brings us closer and closer to the ultimate shape of the Roman Revolution, which will manifest itself in the 60s and 50s and 40s BC with the rise to power of men such as Cnaeus Pompeius and Gaius Julius Caesar, the man who was to prove the best player at this game and set the Roman state in many ways on a new course. That will be the subject of our future lectures. But for the next time, I'm going to focus specifically on the decade of the 70s and at the gradual process of unravelling of Sulla's attempted restoration, as it's often called.
Lecture 23, Sulla's Reforms Undone.
Hello and welcome back to the History of Ancient Rome and the 23rd lecture in our series. We are in the midst of the Roman Revolution. In the last lecture, we examined the career and depredations of Sulla, Lucius Cornelius Sulla, in the period that the Romans, later Romans, called the Regnum Sullanum, the royal rule of Sulla. This is how they described it. They were under no illusions as to what Sulla was doing. Sulla's reputation in subsequent sources, by the way, is somewhat mixed in many ways. He was abhorred for his actions, especially the proscriptions in marching in Rome and so forth. At the same time, as a champion of the Senate, he was held up in certain quarters or by certain people as at least having the right ideas, even if his execution, no pun intended, wasn't the most admirable. What I want to do in this lecture today is to examine the undoing of Sulla's attempted restoration of the privileges of the Senate, of the dominance of the Senate in the state. Sulla had, as we saw, essentially attempted to legislate what had been, in the old republic, had been simply an accepted practice, an accepted situation. He had attempted to legislate the political dominance of the Senate by his dictatorial decrees. Over the course of the 70s BC, this system, this Sullan restoration, the Sullan settlement, was undone completely. By 70 BC, in fact, it was entirely washed away. And what I want to do today is examine the developments that chart that gradual undoing of Sulla's settlement. But this proves to be a very difficult task. The 70s are worst documented decade of the Roman Revolution. We don't have very good sources at all for this period. So charting the exact step-by-step developments, the, you know, legislative developments that brought about the undoing of the Sullan settlement is extremely difficult and will be too time-consuming and require too much argumentation about source material to carry out effectively in this environment. So what we'll do instead is look at the developments in the affairs of Rome and Italy that illustrate the and brought about the undoing of the Sullan settlement, even if we can't necessarily precisely say at every stage when this or that rule or regulation of Sulla was repealed. Suffice it to say that in broad outline, the Sullan settlement was gradually unravelled. We hear, for instance, that around the middle part of the 70s, 75, 74 perhaps, tribunes began holding assemblies of the people at which they would discuss issues again, for instance. In 75 BC we hear that one of the consuls of that year reopened the subsequent magistracies to tribunes. So small bites were coming out of the Sullan settlement at various stages. But we will look, I think, at the bigger picture, and particularly at the emergence in these years of two new players in the story of the Roman Republic and the unravelling of the Roman constitution. Those players are, respectively, Cneius Pompeius Magnus, known to us in the anglicised version of his name as Pompey, who was to be the great rival of Caesar, and Pompey's first rival, Marcus Licinius Crassus, in many ways a very enigmatic figure in the Roman Revolution, a fascinating man, rather enigmatic, and with priorities somewhat different from those of his colleagues. So in the process then of this lecture, we will examine the broad developments in Italy and elsewhere that led to the unravelling of Sulla's settlement, but also we'll be looking at the emergence of these new players in the drama of the Roman Revolution. Signs of trouble were already to be noticed even before Sulla's death in 78. The consuls of 78 BC hated each other, and one of them in particular, Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, who had joined, or at least become prominent, as a pro-Sullan and had benefited financially greatly from the proscriptions, buying up cheap property of people who had been proscribed by Sulla, proved himself to be a total opportunist, however, and immediately began to agitate against the Sullan settlement, agitating for the return of the rights of the tribunate and the council of the plebs, for instance. When he was unsuccessful in these attempts, Lepidus ominously took a leaf from Sulla's book and resorted to armed insurrection. He had been appointed as proconsul to the province of Cisalpine Gaul, and he used his position there to rustle up various forces, including many disaffected Italians who had suffered because of Sulla's proscriptions, who'd had their lands confiscated and so forth, put together an army and marched on Rome in 77 BC. So in other words, within 2 years of Sulla's giving up his dictatorship and within a year of his death, already people are following his lead. And when they fail in the constitutional path, if you like, when they fail in carrying a legislative program, they're going to resort to warfare. The Senate was forced to declare martial law, the Senatus Consultum Ultimum, and raised forces and defeated Lepidus just outside the gates of Rome itself. Lepidus' behaviour, of course, is very ominous for what was to come. The revolt of Marcus Aemilius Lepidus and the subsequent activities of another supporter of Marius and the anti-Sullans, if you want to put it that way, in Spain, bring to prominence Pompey for the first time. We have to rewind a little bit to see the emergence of Pompey for the first time, which goes all the way back to Sulla's first appearance in Italy on his return from the East in 83 BC. At that time, Pompey, a young nobleman from the northwestern part of Italy, the Picene area, raised several legions out of his own money, out of his own family's money, and marched them down to Sulla to offer his assistance in Sulla's campaign. So he shows up for the first time in history as a young opportunist joining hands with Sulla in the civil wars of 83 BC. He showed such audacity and daring that he earned the respect of Sulla. We hear, for instance, that Pompey was the only man for whom Sulla would rise out of his chair when Pompey entered the room. So he seemed to have earned the respect, and Sulla sent him against his opponents in Africa and Sicily in the late 80s, and he proved successful. And upon returning to Rome, Pompey demanded from Sulla, his master, if you like, his dog handler in many ways, a triumph. This was a singular sort of military procession that was offered to Roman generals. By tradition, they had to be consuls who had defeated a foreign enemy with Roman arms and killed over a certain number of people and gotten a certain amount of booty and so forth. And this was a remarkable event aimed at by many ambitious Roman military leaders, because basically you were king for a day. In Rome, you entered Rome in purple robes with your face painted purple, apparently in imitation of the statue of Jupiter that stood in the Capitol, in a chariot drawn by white horses with your army in full arm, full, basically parade gear, highly polished parade gear behind you. This was the one occasion when an army could enter Rome under arms by custom, and displaying the slaves and booty and spoils of your campaign and so forth behind you. Huge day when you basically raised yourself above your peers and were recognized generally as a great person. It lasted, of course, only one day, and at the end of it then you reverted to being a member of the aristocracy. Point is, here is Pompey showing something of his audacity by demanding this right, even though he was only a guy at this stage about 26 years of age. And he's demanding this particular privilege, and it was, in fact, Sulla, who gave him his later nickname, Magnus, the Great, Pompey the Great, no doubt with his tongue in his cheek, and granted him the right to have a triumph. So when Lepidus revolted, Pompey, who was sort of hanging around in the wings, was called up by the Senate. He had proven himself to be a military commander of worth. He was called up by the Senate. Remember, the Senate dominated by Sulla's people to help put down Lepidus's revolt. He was granted the imperium of a pro praetor. Remember, he'd never held any position, any official magistracy. So we're getting into a new stage of the revolution now. People being given power, even though they're really untried and totally against precedent. Given the power of a pro praetor and given the command against Lepidus, which he succeeded in carrying out effectively. Pompey then, at the head of his army, returned to Rome, camped his army outside the city, and suggested to the Senate that he be given a command in Spain, where a fascinating character, very much a side player in the big picture of the Roman Revolution, but a fascinating man in his own right, Quintus Sertorius, was busy. Sertorius was a anti-Sullan who had fought against Sulla during the campaigns in Italy, and had then, when the Sinans and the Marians had failed in Italy, had retired to Spain, where he formed a sort of counter-Rome out of the Italian immigrants in Spain and the people of Spain themselves, where he was immensely popular, formed a counter-Senate, began issuing coinage and so forth, almost as if he was refusing to recognize the validity of the Sullan-dominated republic. Sertorius then was a major challenge to the Sullan regime and was in arms against the state. And so Pompeius requested, with his army camped outside the city, requested that he be given the command against Sertorius, and was granted the request, naturally enough. So from 77 BC to 72 BC, Pompey was occupied with his campaigns, very difficult campaigns indeed, against Sertorius, who comes across in the ancient sources as a military commander of some considerable ability. After about 6 years of fighting, Pompey eventually proved himself successful. Sertorius's support began to wane in the face of his lack of success, and eventually the poor man was murdered by a jealous underling, and the whole issue of Sertorius and the counter-Rome of Spain evaporated. While Pompey was busy in Spain, events in Rome brought to light and brought to prominence another major player in our story, Marcus Licinius Crassus. Crassus was of patrician stock. The Licinii were an ancient patrician family, and he had also benefited enormously from Sulla's prescriptions, buying up expensive properties at knockdown prices because the owners had been proscribed and murdered. He also had a variety of interesting commercial money-making schemes that he used to do. We hear that he was one of the first people to own large bands of slaves, which he rented out for a variety of purposes to people. And he also had a very interesting fire brigade scam. Rome at this time was physically, would have been a rather unimpressive looking place, plenty of wooden plaster buildings, some impressive public buildings, but not terribly many. And the living conditions of the people, of the average people, would have been quite cramped and crowded. And the threat of fire was a perpetual problem in the city. At the same time, there was no organized civic fire brigade. So Crassus saw here a possibility for some money making. The story goes, when a fire would break out, Crassus would show up with a group of his slaves equipped to put the fire out. He would then offer to purchase the property off the owner on the spot, and also offer to purchase the neighboring properties at knockdown prices. If the owners refused, Crassus would go away and the entire place would burn down. If the owner agreed, then Crassus would put the fire out and he would have acquired property for a knockdown price. This is the sort of thing that Crassus did, apparently. So he had amassed for himself, between the prescriptions and his various commercial dealings, an enormous wealth, which he deployed in enormous bribing operations to secure election for himself to the various positions in the state. He had risen up, however, through the ranks in good order. He hadn't displayed himself yet as a revolutionary or anything like it. Had risen up in proper sequence at the proper age limits and so forth, until by 73 BC he was praetor of Rome. It just so happens that 73 BC also sees the beginning of a major event in Rome, which was to give Crassus his shot at military glory. Although Crassus was affluent and wealthy, wealth in and of itself was not something that the Romans particularly admired. What they really admired was military achievement. This had been displayed in no small way by Marius's meteoric rise to prominence on the back of military glory at the end of the 2nd century BC. So, in 73 BC, word came from the south of Italy that a group of 20 gladiators had broken out of their training camp at the town of Capua. At their head was a Thracian named Spartacus, and he had encamped himself on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius, where slaves of all sorts were flocking to his banner. This causes us to pause, I think, and appreciate what we're talking about in terms of the demographics of the Italian countryside at this time. We have seen that with the rise of the Roman Empire especially in the 2nd century BC, large numbers of people had fallen into Roman hands as slaves. The population, the slave population of Italy would be impossible to assess, but we had seen as well how large numbers of them were used in ever-increasingly enormous estates, as slave gangs working these estates under rich landowners. Especially in Sicily, this was a very common feature, apparently, of the countryside, and already there had been a forewarning of the dangers here, when in 135 BC there had been a vast slave uprising in Sicily that had taken several consular armies to put down and 3 years of hard fighting. The slaves, by the way, at this time had a king that they seem to have elected, a man called Eunus, at their head. He must have been a very colourful character, comes across as that from the sources. And on the recent trip to Italy, I had the fortune to pass by the town, the hilltop town, that Eunus used as his base of operations in the centre of Sicily on that occasion. But in 73 BC, the situation was somewhat different. This is on the mainland of Italy. In fact, at the heart of what was already, for the Romans, something of a playground, sort of a pleasure area, Campania. The situation with Spartacus also requires us to briefly consider the issue of gladiators. I'll be turning my attention at a later date the story of the gladiators in more detail. But in the first century BC, the popularity of this form of entertainment had really increased hugely, and many men were making a lot of money out of maintaining gladiatorial schools. These schools were arranged usually in the south of Italy, and it was out of a gladiatorial training school that Spartacus broke out. We must imagine that life in these schools was especially brutal and vicious when we consider what the men were being trained to do, was to fight each other to the death for the entertainment of the mob. And so it's not surprising to find Spartacus trying to break out. His motives aren't exactly a mystery to us. It also meant, of course, that Spartacus and the initial band of 20 that broke out of this training school at Capua would have been highly trained fighters. These would be people who could, and in fact did, form the kernel of really quite a significant fighting force, quite a powerful army, well trained in the methods of gladiatorial fighting, and so something of a match for Roman forces that were sent against them. So Spartacus took up camp on Mount Vesuvius, and the thousands of dispossessed people and slaves working the fields of the estates flocked to his banner of revolt. He quickly trained these into a fighting force, and it seems that initially the Romans didn't take the matter seriously. They regarded it more as a major crime wave in South Italy and didn't consider it to be a matter of terrible importance. And so the initial forces that they sent against the slaves were rather small and were quickly crushed. Then, however, the rebel slaves began to raid and burn the estates and villas of the rich in the area of Campania and South Italy, and the matter became somewhat more serious in Roman eyes. Armies were sent against the slaves, and they were defeated. It seems that Spartacus's motives, or at least his objectives, are somewhat unclear to us. What we can say is that unlike the Hollywood version, which is a fine movie, by the way, Spartacus, but unlike the Hollywood version, he was undoubtedly not fighting for the end of slavery as an institution and the equality of all people. It seems, again, something that we'll see later when we look at Roman slavery, that such notions didn't cross anyone's mind in the ancient world. But he does seem to have been trying to fight for a breakout of Italy and a move north across the Alps into the Celtic lands to the north, because his initial thrust was northward up the Apennines towards the Alps, but he was blocked by the Roman forces and was forced to turn south again. And finally, he was hemmed in south of Italy, because Crassus was called to help put the matter down. Crassus was given a pro-praetorian command, since the consular armies had done so badly. And we hear that he was quite ruthless in his installation of discipline. We hear that Crassus' command was 6 legions under his pro-praetorian imperium. And he was joined by the remnants of the consular armies that had failed against Spartacus. And his first act was to decimate them for cowardice and failure to put down slaves. It's said that over 4,000 men died in this act of decimation, this punishment of the armies. This, we are told by our main source for this whole incident, Appian, this instilled a tremendous fear in the soldiers, who reckoned that it was better to die bravely fighting slaves than to be executed by your own commander. And as a result, they fought very fiercely in the last phases of the war. We're now looking at the year 71 BC. So having hemmed Spartacus in the south of Italy, around the town of Thurii, Crassus and his armies succeeded in beating down the rebellion. Eventually, Spartacus was defeated in battle. We hear that he himself was killed in the battle, although his body was never located on the field afterwards. The fate of the survivors of Spartacus's army, slaves all, remember, was an object lesson in Roman severity. All 6,000 of them, we hear, were crucified along the Appian Way between Rome and Campania. However, as the slave war was going a bit slowly, Crassus operated relatively quickly. He had the war over within 6 months or so of being given the command. But still, bands of slaves were breaking out and were still to be found in various parts of South Italy, so that when Pompey returned from Spain, the Senate urged him to help in the mopping up of the slave revolt. As a result, Pompey, in Crassus's eyes, moved in on his glory, moved in on his territory of glory. This, after all, in Crassus's view, was his chance at military glory, unblemished. Pompey had enough. Why did he want more? Why did he come in to claim any of the glory that Crassus felt was due to him alone? As a result, Crassus and Pompey became enemies. The next few days are of great interest to us. After the end of the Spartan War, what we find happening next is that Pompey moved his army outside Rome, camped it outside the city of Rome, and requested a consulship. He was 36 years of age and to date had held no magistracy of the Roman people. Crassus, remember, was still in control of his troops that had fought against Spartacus. And it might be hoped that Crassus would employ his troops to block this blatantly intimidatory move by his rival Pompey. Crassus moved his army up in the vicinity of Rome and camped it there. Crassus then demanded a consulship for himself. He did not block Pompey. He imitated him. And the result was absolutely clear for those of us observing the pattern of events in the Roman Revolution. The Senate, without armament, with only its name and tradition behind it, could do nothing in the face of two armies with two ambitious generals at the head demanding consulships. Both men were given consulships for the year 70 BC. In many ways, this event heralds, more so even than Sulla's march in Rome, heralds a new era of the Roman Revolution, the era of the military dynasts, the powerful generals at the heads of essentially personal armies, armies whose loyalties are directed at themselves, occasionally resorting to constitutional means, occasionally approaching the Senate, occasionally using tribunes, and when all else fails, appealing to the support of their armies to extort commands and privileges from an unarmed and essentially helpless Senate. This increasingly will be the pattern of events for the remainder of the Roman Revolution. It's funny to read that Pompey was so ignorant of the procedures of being a Roman magistrate that he had to ask a friend and scholar, Marcus Terentius Varro, to write him up a handbook so that he would know how to behave and what to say and what to wear for the various occasions that he knew he would be called upon to act as consul of the Roman people. Pompey and Crassus, then, technically enemies, find themselves as consuls in 70 BC, and they stage a public reconciliation, which I've always imagined in rather comic terms as plenty of stiff smiles and handshakes for the non-existent cameras, but actually, underneath it all, seething resentment and personal dislike. But a public reconciliation that at least ensured that there wasn't going to be an immediate threat of armed insurrection between the two of them for the foreseeable. They set about the final dismantlement of Sulla's settlement of the Roman state. The courts that Sulla had established, the permanent courts, were left stand, but the juries of those courts were taken away from pure senatorial control and divided up into equal thirds between senators, equestrians, and a mysterious group of people called tribuni aerarii. We don't know who they are. It means tribunes of the treasury, but we don't know exactly how that group was determined or who they were. A good example, again, of how our sources are so patchy and unclear. We hear about these guys, we just don't know who they are. If only we did, it would make life clearer. But the point is that the senatorial control over the courts is removed. Censors were established under the consulship of Pompey and Crassus for the first time in 17 years, and with the result that many of the cronies of Sulla who had been installed in the Senate now found themselves expelled. But most importantly, the tribunate of the plebs was restored to its full pre-Sullan powers. All this in 70 BC. So by the end of 70 BC, within 8 years of Sulla's death, 9 years of his abdication of his dictatorship, his attempted restoration had failed. There can be little doubt that Crassus and Pompey's motive in restoring the tribunate was not love of the people, especially in the case of Crassus, or a desire to see democracy restored or any such thing. It was a desire to open up yet another avenue for extorting what they wanted out of the state. They could use their armies, they could approach the Senate, and now they had the avenue of the tribal assembly of the plebs and compliant tribunes open to them as well. And we see Pompey making use of that avenue almost immediately. So the early careers then of Crassus and Pompey show us that the Sullan settlement was absolutely doomed. Roman politics had become completely cutthroat and vicious prior to Sulla's settlement. Sulla himself had contributed in no small measure to that viciousness, as we saw with the proscriptions. Sulla's military career had offered a precedent and an example of the dizzying heights that one could reach when one used one's army for political purposes. And that Lepidus openly revolted, and Crassus and Pompey more cryptically employed their armies for purposes of intimidation, boded extremely ill indeed for the future of the Roman Republic. And as we'll see in the next lecture, the next decade, the 60s BC, was to see the rivalry between Crassus and Pompey continue, and in the context of that rivalry, the emergence of a new player, Gaius Julius Caesar.
Lecture 24, Pompey and Crassus.
Welcome back to lecture 24 now of the History of Ancient Rome with the Teaching Company. We are in the midst of the Roman Revolution. We have seen the beginnings of the process with the Gracchi brothers, the escalation toward a politicized military with Marius, the use of that politicized military by Sulla, the continued use of the military and the tribunes by the early careers of Pompey and Crassus. What I want to do in this lecture today is continue the story, basically covering the decade of the 60s BC, not quite the entire decade. We'll stop in the year 63 BC, which is an extremely eventful year in Roman history for a variety of reasons. What I wish to do then is outline to you in the course of this lecture the continued rivalry between Pompey and Crassus that was shaping up, threatening to lead to yet another civil war. As we'll see, in fact, Crassus's efforts to block the enormous popularity of Pompey, which in the course of the 60s rose to new heights on the back of various developments in foreign affairs, was to bring into the picture a new and very able, it turns out, player in the political theatre of the Roman Revolution, Julius Caesar, Gaius Julius Caesar. So we will introduce Caesar today and look at the early part of his career and maybe capture something of his character from a story or two, and then we will end with a closer look at the year 63 BC, which is an important one in Roman history. Events in the 60s were to catapult Pompey once more into the limelight. He already was something of a darling of the people by virtue of his success in military affairs and because he had helped mop up the Spartacan slave revolt. But in the 60s BC, he really became the chief man in the Roman state. There can be no doubt that he was, in the 60s, the most powerful Roman alive. It was events in foreign affairs that were to be the basis for Pompey's continued success. So we must turn our attention once more eastward and once again to Mithridates of Pontus, who had been let off the hook by Sulla, as we saw in the mid-80s, had embarked on a minor round of wars with Rome at the end of the 80s, had then been relatively quiet, it turns out, biding his time, until launching another more serious round of campaigns against the Romans in the mid-70s BC. This, the so-called Third Mithridatic War, got underway in earnest in 75 BC, And in the course of this new campaign, Mithridates exploited a new ally. The ally came in the form of pirates who inhabited the area known in ancient times as Rough Cilicia. This is the area along the southern coast of Turkey, and if any of you have ever had the chance to visit there, you'll realize that it lives up well to its ancient name. The mountains of Turkey come right down to the sea at this point. There are plenty of inlets and harbors, lots and lots of caves for the pirates to hide themselves and their loot and their prisoners. And it seems that the pirates of Rough Cilicia formed sort of a brigand kingdom of sorts, forts and fortresses dotted along the coast, and were really largely impregnable and impervious to attack when they were well ensconced in their homeland. But from Cilicia, they would sally out across the Mediterranean, and in fact, the whole problem of piracy and brigandage on the land was an endemic one in the ancient world. In the absence of effective police forces and so on, pirates and brigands could always be found in the gaps between the civilized areas. And it seems that in the course of the early part of the first century BC, the pirates had grown to new levels of power. In some ways, one can say that the rise of the pirates to such a serious problem is a symptom of the Roman Revolution and the fact that the Senate and government of Rome is not paying attention to its proper duties, as it's so obsessed with the constitutional issues that really lie at the heart of the Roman Revolution. But several stories will illustrate how powerful the pirates had become by the early 60s BC, especially by the year 67 BC, when the war with Mithridates was still ongoing and his alliance with the pirates was proving most effective. The pirates had taken to raiding the coast of Italy itself. They would come right up to the shore and raid coastal towns and even send in parties inland to attack villas of the rich and affluent that lay some way inland, using the Roman network of roads for their own advantage. They captured, for instance, the daughter of an ex-consul who disappeared and was never seen or heard from again. Two praetors in their full Roman regalia were seized and captured by the pirates in 68 BC. And they seem to have also launched a raid on the Roman fleet while it was at anchor in the harbour of Ostia, the very harbour of Rome itself. The most important ramification of the activities of the pirates was that the grain supply to Rome was now coming under threat. The Romans themselves imported much of their grain, especially from Sicily and from eastern lands, from Africa as well. And this grain, as we've seen, was one of the many pawns in the Roman Revolution that was often used by tribunes and so forth to promote popular measures, the offer of cheap grain to the people. So the grain supply was something very important to the urban mob of the city of Rome. The pirates were now threatening that grain supply. And as a result, the power of the pirates had become intolerable to the urban mob, and they wanted something done about this problem. Well, Pompey was on hand. This was his moment. Using a tribune, Aulus Gabinius, he proposed, well, Gabinius proposed, but no doubt with Pompey's full support and undoubtedly at his instigation, proposed a law conferring a vast imperium on Pompey's shoulders to deal with the pirate problem. The law was passed eventually amidst scenes of tremendous disorder. People who in any way tried to question whether or not one Roman should have so much power conferred upon him were shouted down. There's a rather colourful anecdote that on one occasion one of the tribunes attempting to intercede a veto received such a roar of disapproval from the mob that a raven flying overhead was killed by the percussion and dropped onto the ground. But there were scenes of tremendous disorder and violence as Gabinius had his law passed that conferred upon Pompey a new level of imperium, formerly unknown, imperium infinitum, imperium without boundaries. That means that Pompey had power that was not restricted to a specific province. In fact, the power of Pompey, by virtue of this law of the tribune Gabinius in 67 BC, was to stretch over the entire Mediterranean Sea, all the islands in the Mediterranean Sea, and all the coastal regions bordering the sea for 50 miles inland. Pompey would have more power than any one of the governors on the spot throughout this vast area. Furthermore, it was considered that Pompey would need at least 3 years to dispense his duties. So the grant of imperium was for 3 years, or until he'd